Chapter 15. Music is there for those who listen. That's what she looked like. That's what she felt like. But that's impossible, right? I mean, ghosts aren't real. It had to be an illusion. Or, like Colin said, my brain's too frozen to think straight. What am I doing up here? How did I end up on a frozen mountain peak, thousands of miles from home, and now with a ghost following me? At that moment, despair washes over me. Maybe I don't belong here. Maybe I'm fighting for something I can never have. It was easy enough to say I could do it when I had my flute in my hands, but right now I have nothing. I came here to get answers about my mom. Who was she? Am I anything like her? But instead, all I get is a possible, honest-to-bock ghost. And she's not the only thing haunting me. I can still hear the squeaky A note from my audition, howling with the wind, reminding me every second that I'm not good enough. Wait a minute. That note isn't my imagination. It's coming from above me. I turn and look up, squinting in the gloomy light, until I see it. A hole in a rock, as neat and round as if it had been cut out with a pair of scissors. The wind is howling through it, creating an almost perfect A note. Weird. I stand up and walk closer, only to trip over another jutting rock. I reach out to pull myself up and find another hole. Then I see them everywhere. All across the mountaintop, there are rocks with holes in them. You'd miss them completely if you weren't looking for them, because they're impossible to see without eyeing them straight on. That's probably why we didn't see them earlier. When I get closer, I can hear the wind howling through them at different pitches. And then it all makes sense. It's just like the school motto. Music is there for those who listen. I run back to the cave as quickly as I can, shouting for the others. Because of the wind, they don't hear me until I'm just steps away. I skid to a halt, breathless, and gasp out, "I know what to do! I know what to do!" A few people look up curiously, but Claudia scowls. "Let me guess, you saw an entire freaking elephant this time." Ignoring her, I walk to Darby. "You said if we had instruments, you could conduct us." She looks up. "That's not exactly what I found instruments." Now everyone jumps up, looking interested. Even Claudia folds her arms, waiting for me to explain. Skipping the part about the ghost, or illusion, or whatever she was, I tell them about the holes in the rocks, and how the wind makes different pitches as it whistles through them. At first they look doubtful, but then they follow me out to have a look themselves.
"Listen," shouts Colin.
He puts a hand over one of the holes, blocking the wind and stopping the sound it makes. Then he removes his hand and the note sounds again. "This is it," says Claudia. "The mountain is our instrument." "The holes are spread out," I say, "but there are 25 of them. We each take one and put our hands over the holes, then remove them to play the spell. It's sort of like handbells, where we all are in charge of different notes. This is how we light the signal fire." "But there are only 25 holes," says Claudia. "And there are 26 of us." I nod. That's because Darby has a different job. I turn to look at my roommate, who stands silently with the baton at her side. Every orchestra needs a conductor. She has to be in charge of the spell, making sure we play together. Darby looks down at the baton, then up at me, her eyes wide.
I can't.
"Yes, you can," I say. "Or is someone else here trained to conduct?" No one volunteers. "Well, that's settled then," Claudia says. "Darby's conducting, and each of us takes a wind hole thing. Anyone have an idea for a spell to light the firewood?" "The itsy bitsy spider," I say at once. She rolls her eyes. "That's a drying spell, Jones. So speed up the tempo. Trust me, it will work." She looks doubtful, but shrugs. It takes a few minutes to get everyone organized, and then we have to figure out which holes make which notes. We arrange ourselves in a scale after discovering that altogether, the holes cover 4 octaves. It takes a bit of arguing before we settle on an arrangement that uses all the notes. As I point out, it's going to take each of us playing to generate a powerful enough spell to light the cold, wet firewood. Finally, though, we get it worked out and move into our places. Some of the holes are difficult to reach, and a few students have to lie on their stomachs or stand on tiptoe. Darby reluctantly takes up position where we can all see her, though we can't all see each other. She somehow has to remember which of us has which notes and get us all to play them at the right time. Meanwhile, we each have to focus on the pile of firewood, which we can see above us on the highest rock behind Darby. "Ready?" Darby shouts over the wind. I nod, my hand clamped over the hole in my rock. Claudia's on my left and Colin on the right. The first time we try to play the spell, it goes terribly. Darby mixes up the notes, and we don't even produce a single wisp of magic. Frustrated, she has us start over. Her baton bobs to keep the tempo, but more importantly, she points at whoever's turn it is to play. The second time, Colin misses her direction and doesn't release his note in time, and the spell bungles again.
"Hey, Colin!" shouts George. "Pay closer attention to your a-hole!"
George laughs so hard at his own stupid joke that we have to wait a whole minute before starting again. Three more times we fail, but on the fourth try, we finally manage to get a bit of smoke off the firewood. It's still not enough. "We have to play faster," I say. "This spell isn't working," Claudia argues. "We should try Haydn's 59th Symphony." "Claudia," I give her a flat look. "We're playing with rocks. We can't exactly grind out a symphony here."
"The problem isn't the spell," shouts Darby. "It's me. I keep messing up."
"You're doing great," I call back.
"No, I'm not.
Just try one more time." Her eyes are glittering with tears, but she raises her baton. I draw a deep breath, then focus myself once more. This has to work. This time, we succeed. Sort of. As our notes sound, hollow, breathy tones that remind me of a pan flute, streams of blue magic curl from the rocks, looking ghostly in the twilight. I've never seen magic done like this before, and it makes my skin break out in goosebumps that have nothing to do with the cold. This isn't just any spell. This is big magic. This is what I came to Mistwick to learn. I watch the flickering magic as it coils through the air, hoping it will reach the wood, that the signal will light, that we'll finally get off this mountain. But instead of the firewood catching flame, Darby's baton does. She yelps and drops it, the slim rod crackling with fire at one end. "Don't let it go out," I yell, leaving my rock to sprint toward her. I grab the baton and cut my hand around the flame. "We can still make it." Darby stares at the flaming baton.
"I messed it up," she whispers. "I was concentrating on the baton, making sure I kept the tempo instead of..."
"Forget it," I say, and I take off, jumping from rock to rock, making my way toward the pile of wood. The flame on the baton starts shrinking. "Hang in there," I mutter. "Come on, come on." I reach the wood just in time, managing to stick the baton into the smaller kindling at the bottom. The twigs catch fire, and I desperately blow on them, for once grateful that Gran made me join Girl Scouts in her quest to persuade me to give up music craft. In moments, a steady blaze has spread across the wood. With a sigh of relief, I hold out my hands, relishing the warmth. The rest of the class gathers around, looking just as relieved, but we're all too tired and cold to cheer. Darby hangs back, sitting on a rock with her back to us. Cautiously, I approach her. "Darby, are you okay?"
"Leave me alone, Jones."
"You did it. You got us to create fire."
"Not the right way. You're the one who lit the signal. I couldn't even focus long enough to finish one stupid spell."
Now she turns a bit, but doesn't look me in the eye.
"I'm an oboist, Jones, and I'm a really good one. But I'm not a conductor. Not anymore. That was something I only did with my Amelia. She got me into it, and ever since she died..."
She turns away again.
"Just leave me alone, will you?"
Sighing, I go back to the fire and sit. A few minutes later,
A rock beside the bonfire jiggles, and Jingfei, who'd been sitting on it, jumps aside with a shout. The rock slides away, and from beneath it pops Mr. Pinwhistle. We all stare at the maestro, and he glares back. The rock was covering the way down the whole time, a deep, square hole with a ladder inside.
"Took you long enough. Now what are you waiting for?" he growls. "I'm freezing my butt off. Let's go."
It's a long climb down the ladder to a tunnel in the heart of the mountain. My cold fingers make it hard to grip the rungs, but at least I'm not the only one. We're all stiff and slow. Once on level ground, we follow Mr. Pinwhistle closely through the dark tunnel, since he's the only one with a flashlight. The walls are rough stone, the floor mud, and eerie dripping sounds echo around us. I wonder how deep this cave system goes, and hope I never have to find out. Who knows what other kind of demented tests Mr. Pinwhistle has up his sleeves. And yet, for all the pain this little exercise was, I can't help but feel proud of my part in solving it. Maybe now the others will take me more seriously. After what feels like hours of walking, the tunnel ends in the Echo Wood, just behind Harmony Hall. The dark trees are almost welcoming after the mountain. They're still tonight, no wind to stir their magic. In silent single file, we leave the woods and make for the hall. But before he lets us go inside, Mr. Pinwhistle stops us.
"Well,"
he grunts,
"what did you learn?"
There's a moment of silence. Jingfei coughs. Finally, Colin bravely raises a hand.
To always bring a jacket to class, just in case."
Mr. Pinwhistle sighs long and deep, his hand dragging across his face.
"Anyone else?"
"Music is there for those who listen," I whisper.
"Eh?"
Mr. Pinwhistle cups a hand around his ear.
"What did you say?"
I swallow, then say louder. "Music is there for those who listen?" He lowers his hand, giving me a thoughtful look.
"Well, now that is an important lesson, isn't it? Also, for those of you who care, remember that you should never rely too much on traditional instruments. A little imagination can come in handy when you're in a tight spot. And there's more than one way to make music. Anyway, go inside and get your dinner. I suspect it's cold by now. And don't forget, we have a transposing test tomorrow."
An hour later, I'm finally lying in my bed, full after a meal of tomato soup and grilled cheese, which, contrary to Mr. Pinwhistle's prediction, the cafeteria had kept warm for us. Phoebe even brought us hot chocolate, with a knowing look on her face that tells me the mountaintop test must be a yearly thing. Darby is a silent bundle of blankets across the room, probably already asleep. We haven't spoken again since Mr. Pinwhistle appeared to take us back, and I realize it was too much to hope things between us might have changed. She still seems determined to ignore me and everyone else. But right now, it's hard to be upset about that. I've never been so happy to be so warm. Then I remember the girl on the mountain. The see-through girl who hovered in midair and attacked me as if she was trying to make me fall off the cliff. My mind spins like a hamster wheel. The wind that messed up my apple peeling test. The person shining lights in my room all night long. The girl who tried to drown me during my test in the shell. Somehow I just know they're all connected, and the girl I saw on the mountain is the cause. Maybe it's time to finally admit the truth I've been too afraid to face. Someone at Mistwick is trying to sabotage me, and that someone is a ghost.